Good morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. If everyone could find a seat or somewhere to stand, I'm sorry, it's so crowded today. We were really sold out. I'm Kate Slevin. I'm the Vice President of State Programs and Advocacy for Regional Plan Association. Thank you so much for coming to this panel about improving transit options in the suburbs and outer boroughs. Before we get started, and I pass it over to the very impressive panel we have today, I wanted to give a little bit of context about RPA's work and our perspective on the issues we're talking about this morning. Many of the room have heard that the transportation revolution is coming, but when you look at some of the data that we compiled for the fourth regional plan, it shows that another sort of revolution is already happening, which is essentially consolidating jobs and population in dense cities. NYC has added about 100,000 people per year annually, about 70,000 jobs annually over the past number of years, which is a complete reversal from the period before when all of the jobs were being created outside of New York City. And this has forced tremendous pressure on our transportation network. And it's essentially buckling under the growth. For decades, this growth that we saw was happening basically on the backs of transit, on buses. It was increasing transit ridership. But that has changed, and now we're growing in actually a less sustainable way because auto use is increasing with the increasing proportion of for-hire rides and other car trips in the city. Our transit system just can't keep up with the pace of growth we're seeing. Buses in particular have seen shrinking declines over the past number of years, and Tom alluded to that this morning. And this decline extends far beyond New York City's borders to all of the areas around New York City, all of the suburban areas as well. The fourth regional plan essentially says, whoa, let's take a pause here. Let's grow in a way we want to grow, and let's be intentional about our growth and grow more sustainably in a way that benefits everyone and not just a select few. And it says that we should plan for the future we want. We created this image for the fourth plan to show when AVs, autonomous vehicles, might come onto our streets. If we want to reach this future in 2040, where we have more green space in our streets, more bicycle lanes, safer places for walking, more space for transit, and more sustainable city, we need to start planning now, and we need to be intentional about how we plan. We call for changing zoning and creating new development around train stations so we can accommodate hundreds of thousands of new homes. And it calls for investing in our core transit network. For example, these are the dozens of lines on the surface in New York City that we think warrant added service, priority treatments, and other things to allow people to get where they want to go faster. This includes a new transit link, which is the black line you see running from Bay Ridge up through Brooklyn and Queens and into the Bronx. And we call that the Triborough Line. It's currently an existing rail freight line that has about one rail freight train a day. And we think it could be used in a much more efficient way if you allowed passenger service on that line. And the great thing is the right-of-way is already there. And for cities like Newark, we also see a greater investment in transit and better connections to places and centers that are outside of the urban core. We know if we're going to grow equitably, we can't just grow Manhattan. We have to grow the cities around the region as well. And we call on suburban areas to harness new technology so it complements development goals. For example, this program in Summit, New Jersey, subsidizes Uber or Lyft rides to the train station, so there's less pressure for structured parking around the train station. But ultimately, land use will dictate whether we achieve a more sustainable future or not. This is the fourth plan hierarchy we put together for the prioritization on streets, essentially the opposite of what we have now, where most of our streets give preference to private automobiles. Transit cannot effectively serve low-density areas and will never be able to do so. RPA's assembly today is about moving from the fourth plan as a document to one that is driving change and policy throughout the region. As such, these are some of the advocacy priorities we're working on now, and we will keep working on in the years ahead, investing in transit, planning for balanced streets, allowing more development near train stations, and is staying ahead of the technology, especially on the transportation side, that is coming. So I know our panelists have a wide range of views on these topics, and so I'm going to pass it over to our moderator today, Eric Rothman, who's the president of HRNA Advisors. You're a nationally known expert on TOD and transit, so you're the right man for the role.
Great. Thanks,
you.
Kate.
Thanks, everyone.
Good morning, everyone. It's great to be joined this morning by Tabitha Decker of Transit Center, by John Ando from the Dutchess County Public Transit, Margaret Newman, who's a principal at ARIP, as well as a former chief of staff at New York City DOT, and Jason Post from Uber. I was very interested in talking about this topic. For the last couple of years, we've been doing a lot of research and thinking about driverless cars and really trying to think about this question that Kate posed. If they're going to be on the street, whether it's in 2040 or 2030, and relatively ubiquitous, what kind of urban environment, whether that's in center city areas like Manhattan, outer boroughs, or suburbs, do we want to plan for, and how can we actually put in place policies to think about what we can do today while driverless cars are in the relative infancy but coming much faster than any of us probably could have expected. But what are the things that we can do today? What are the things we can do tomorrow so that way we can have vibrant, healthy, sustainable, and equitable places in the future? I was thrilled this morning to listen to Andy Byford from the Transit Authority. When I helped to set up Transport for London with Jay Walder and with Bob Kiley back in the early 2000s, we were pretty impressed as Americans going over there seeing that transit, because it was in a state of crisis, was front page news all the time over there. It's a tough environment to come into, seeing that transit in the crisis is front page news, and when you take up that role. And what a thrill to see not only his focus on the customer and on the person, how to move people around, but to see the head of any transit agency, for those of us who are interested in the field, get a standing ovation in an audience outside of their own employees. So I'm really looking forward to discussion today, both about what's happening on the ground in our region, in the outer boroughs and the suburbs, hopefully thinking outside of our region. I've been doing work in Los Angeles and Dallas, and it's interesting to see that those places, very car-oriented places, are really trying to leverage new technologies and get ahead of the curve, and in two very different ways. So in Dallas, they have what's called a mobility sandbox grant and have set up a public transit agency-owned microtransit service that's using apps and providing on-demand services in very specific places within the region, like in Plano and in South Dallas, to try to bring people to what they always remind us is the nation's longest light rail network. They've got about 100 miles of light rail. It's as in terms of actually market penetration, it's possibly the nation's least used light rail network too. It only has about a 2% market share. In Los Angeles, which many people who don't spend a lot of time there will think, well, it's all about cars. Los Angeles is the second largest public transit market in the U.S., and they have one of the more innovative and have dealt with some of the issues of regionalism structurally in a way better than the New York market has, but one of the more innovative transit agencies in the country from planning through operations. And they're experimenting on a pilot basis with microtransit pilots, bringing the private sector and nonprofit sector in to provide I think that they just announced them this week. They had a large competition. They're going to have a few six-month pilot programs to experiment with microtransit. It's a very old industry. Jitneys have been around forever and are part of microtransit, but using on-demand apps for microtransit is a relatively new industry, and one that I hope that our panelists, and particularly Jason, can talk about. So I want to talk about what's happening now and what we can plan for in the future, and really engage our panelists as well as the audience in a discussion. So without any further ado, I'll have a question for each of the panelists, and then we'll go into a discussion question. So first, starting with Tabitha, if you can talk a bit about what you've been doing at Transit Center, what you've seen around the country, and also your reactions to the bus action plan and how you think they're going to affect outer borough mobility.
Sure. Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Tabitha Decker. I'm the Deputy Executive Director at Transit Center. We're a national foundation, and we're working to reform public transit so that it better meets riders' needs. We do that through a combination of research, advocacy, and leadership development. And one of the things that we're really focused heavily on, both here in the New York region and nationally, is the bus. We actually think that the bus has a very important role to play in the so-called transit revolution, and that right now, bus ridership and performance across the country is in decline. That's the case in New York, which is something we heard a lot about this morning. And it's important to note that if we don't get the fundamentals of transit right, we will not have success in achieving a better city with autonomous vehicles and other promising technologies. For this reason, in New York, we've been very active as a part of the Bus Turnaround Coalition. For the last couple of years, Transit Center has been working in partnership with Riders Alliance, Strap Hangers Campaign, and Tri-State Transportation Campaign to call for some really basic changes that would make buses in New York an actual attractive option for riders. Things like boarding through all doors, redesign of the overall network of our bus network, thinking about dispatching, again, real basics, street design, and you know, there's an exciting moment now. You know, you asked me how we feel about the bus action plan. We think it's tremendous. We think that it's ambitious, it's comprehensive, but there's sort of one key thing that's missing, and that's something that's not, you know, sort of up to the transit agency to establish, and that's priority for buses on our streets. So here we see a huge opportunity for Mayor de Blasio to really dedicate street space to buses with bus lanes that have real enforcement. And that's a technique that we've seen be very successful in other cities around the country. So it's something that we absolutely need here, and that should be an essential part of the reform that we need in order to make autonomous vehicles actually allow us to make the city work better for people.
Great. John, so you're running Dutchess County Public Transit. You've recently taken over the Poughkeepsie services. What are some of the issues that you're facing in Dutchess County, and how is that suburban transit system responding and leveraging new technologies to provide better customer service?
Definitely. As mentioned, I'm John Ando. I'm the County Transit Administrator for Dutchess County Public Transit. And we just recently expanded into the city of Poughkeepsie with the city discontinuing their transit system. So some of the challenges that we're facing because of that is now we're integrating close to 450,000 passenger trips on that little city system into our countywide inner city system and trying to mesh the two demographic groups together. It was an uphill challenge with the merger, very emotional, very political. We had to rebuild relationships by redesigning our transit service within the city to get the buy-in of the ridership of the former city bus riders to accepting that the county is now running their transit service. So we're now at a stage where we now need to start thinking beyond the bus and looking at alternative ways to move people within the urban area, but also within our rural areas. And within 796 square miles of Dutchess County, we have a lot of rural areas where we're taking buses that are carrying very little ridership into. So some of those technologies that we're looking into is seeing if we can partner with transportation network companies, looking at van pools, doing mileage reimbursement programs, using app technology to allow those in the rural areas to know when the bus is going to be coming, even going as far as putting up bus stop signs so people actually know where to catch our services. And being more aggressive with marketing our services so we can become more relevant transportation use within our community.
Great. And Margaret, you're doing work around the region, and obviously ARIP does work around the country and around the world. What are some of the transportation innovations that you're seeing at some of the suburban or outer borough nodes within the region or elsewhere that we should be applying here, both from the transit provision perspective as well as street design?
Sure. Well, good morning, first of all, and I'm really, really excited to be on this panel. It's a topic that I've had the great pleasure of thinking about for quite a few years, and I wanted to start by saying I think when Kate first talked to me about joining, this got me thinking about, well, what are we thinking about suburbs? I mean, we do, Eric does, and we've worked on quite a number of projects over the last few years. I head up the urban design and planning team here in New York, and we do have quite a few public sector clients around the region. But it got me thinking, many of you in the room, and I'm looking around, I won't say everyone here, but I would include myself in this, were educated in, dare I say, the last century, and the latter part of the last century. But I think I was trained as an architect and as an urban designer, and the notion of the suburbs was really not a very positive one as far as design thinking. And I think that the fact that we still call them suburbs is a bit troubling in terms of how we think about both transportation and the way people live in those areas. And I was, in preparation for this panel, I was looking at, there's a fabulous new book that was edited, I think, by Alan Berger from MIT, called Infinite Suburbia, that I would recommend. It's about this thick.
Yeah.
And there's some fabulous essays from some really smart people, a lot of good data on how people are living around the country and around the world, in not in center cities, but in there's a discussion about different types of suburbs, and as suburban post-World War II, post-1980, and then what's been happening in the exurbs post-2010 in this century. So I think it's important when we're talking about transit and how people move around outside of the sort of dense urban centers where I'm a hardcore transit user, and I live in New York. I was born in California, but I live in New York because I hate to drive. But I think those opportunities are not the same everywhere. And so I think the planning of the suburban areas, and I don't have a better word right now, but maybe by the end of this panel we'll come up with one, to talk about what we think of as sort of single-family homes and how people are living there, and the notion of, so there's really three things around that that I sort of think about as we're working on some of our projects. One is the planning, the sort of physical organization of the communities that we're working in, and then what's the model, and then how do people move from one place to another? And obviously that wonderful triangle that Kate showed is sort of ideally suited for denser areas, but not necessarily for places where you have to walk 3 miles to the grocery store. Governance, I think, is really key to what we were talking about in terms of making change. I think one of the great things about the regional plan is that it is first and foremost regional. And so one of the things that we encounter in terms of the work that we're doing, you can't look at just the community where that has control. And you know, Dutchess is a county, Uber is a nation, I don't know, you can't focus on this sort of smaller piece. So the ability to govern regionally and talk regionally about these questions is the second thing. And then the last thing is something that Keller Easterling, who was a colleague of mine from our days teaching at Parsons, talks about subtraction playbook. So how do we look to the future? I think that's the sort of last piece for me. How do you, what can you take away? How can you consolidate things? How can you move things around in a very dense situation where land use is defined? So just quickly, there are four projects. I'm not going to talk about them in detail, but that I've been working on over the last couple of years with AREP that I think represent some approaches to the way communities are looking at their transportation. And Morristown, New Jersey, we had the great pleasure of working with the wonderful Mayor Tim Daugherty, who was really quite fun to work with. And looking at Morristown has a wonderful town green. Those of you who are familiar with it will know that it is not only at the center of Morristown, but it presents some very challenging transportation issues for drivers, as Morristown is on the through route from, as you're moving through New Jersey, coming off I-78 and connecting various parts of other places in New Jersey. So the kind of through traffic was a huge concern for that area. And so it's really commuters and how they're intersecting with the community. So mobility routes and how that intersects with bus routes and with walkers, with pedestrians. Bicycling was not so much of an issue there, but we were looking at actual corridors, transportation corridors. Another place, which is outer borough, but I think has some of the same issues as Morristown in a way, was Jamaica, downtown Jamaica. We were looking at ways to accommodate both a very intense transit system. It's a center for buses and small commuter vans. It's a hub for the Long Island region and for a piece of New York and New York City. And so, how we could modify the streets, the streetscapes around there to accommodate that. So that was another. And we were working directly with New York City DOT on that one. Suffolk County, we were looking at. Has particular challenges, probably somewhat related to some of the issues in Dutchess, having to do with how you optimize transit and how you introduce flexibility in a system that has currently has fixed transit stops. Mm-hmm. So as populations change, move, redensify, how do you remain flexible? Mm-hmm. And then lastly. The Lower Hudson Transit Link, which we've been working with the state and the governor's office to introduce a faster, more efficient bus route from going from Rockland County all the way down into Westchester. And so that will be a series of fixed routes, but through technology means to speed up that commute. So I think that range sort of speaks to some of the things that are out there. I'm not sure that those are all the answers yet, but it's been great to work on those different possibilities.
Great. So Jason is with a transportation networking company. Some might say that Uber is the Uber of transportation networking companies. I think that might have been its pitch for some rounds of funding. But with all that said, obviously you're operating in a very it's a private company that's operating in a very public environment and providing a whole range of different services. And I'm curious, what are some of the big trends that you're seeing within Uber, both from the technology side and the customer side, and particularly with respect to outer borough type locations as well as the services that you provide in the suburbs? And on the New York side, the services you provide in the suburbs is pretty new.
That's right. Thank you, Eric, and it's good to be with everyone. We launched service outside New York City in 4th of July weekend of last year, so particularly in upstate. There were cars from the city that would bounce around and do trips in some of the collar counties and the counties contiguous to those counties, but for all of upstate, ride sharing was new to them last year, and the response has been overwhelmingly positive. And I guess what I would say is that our system in this region was really built to take people from the periphery and bring them in to the central core and send them home at night. And that's what all the fixed guideway lines do. And when you look at the changes in demographics and the changes in land use, like all the upzonings and rezonings that took place under the Bloomberg administration, it's now much more realistic that you could live and work in the same borough, and that borough is not Manhattan. So if you look at Uber in New York City is completing millions of trips per week, and most of those are not in Manhattan. Over half our trips begin or end outside of Manhattan. And when you take out the CBD and you include just upper Manhattan, over 60% of our trips are begin or end outside the CBD. That doesn't include airports. So our trips are not happening, the majority of them are outside the CBD. And I don't think people, I don't know if that's as widely understood. And going back to the system, people take, if you look at ridership patterns in Poughkeepsie and Jamaica, overwhelmingly our top destinations are transit hubs. People take Uber to transit, overwhelmingly. When I've completed trips as an Uber driver, which I do to try and get closer to the experience. In the suburbs, you're taking people to the train. Overwhelmingly, that's the usage pattern. So to the extent we complement what's on the system and use technology to make make utilization more efficient, that's what allows us to bring the price down. So it's actually exciting. And you look, the commuting patterns are changing. People are commuting intra-Brooklyn. People are commuting up to Fairfield County or Westchester, and not just the reverse commute. They're going across, and you know the system was not designed to support that. So that's a problem.
Kate had mentioned before I say this, I'll just say, as you may know from the opening session, we're using a tool called Slido. So there were some directions that were given, but if you go to slido.com, or I think, which is slido.com, I think that sli.do also works. And when you go on there, you'll type in that the meeting you're at is the RPA Assembly, and we are in the Broadway Room. I'm mentioning this because it's a technology that is, believe it or not, going to facilitate the question and answer and discussions that we're going to have afterwards. So the questions will come up. If you see somebody else has asked a question and you like it, say that you like it. And when we get to the audience participation, I'll be looking at a curated list of those questions and probably using some kind of algorithm I'll design in my own head around the number of likes and how much I like the question for whether it gets asked. So please go to Slido. Jason, Kate had mentioned in her intro the pilot program in Summit, which I know you partnered with the municipality. I live near there. For them, it was really about avoiding the cost of building a new parking deck and letting their downtown be more of a downtown and having a little bit less parking right around the train station. I know that either you and Lyft, or Lyft is now providing that. But I'm curious, are there opportunities like that that Uber is exploring elsewhere in the region to bring people to and from trains? And from your perspective, as you know, as a private company, but also the public policy role within the company, where do you think that will work best, and what kind of parameters will make systems like that work best?
I think where the Summit experiment is really interesting and really exciting, and something we're seeing that happens right now. A lot of families have, especially families that live in the suburbs, have a vehicle or have two vehicles, because there are some days when one member of the family, where they both need a car, but not every day. And more we're seeing that families have one car for out-of-town trips. And on those days where they absolutely need a second car, they'll take Uber or another ride-sharing service. Also, the rate at which young people buy cars is decreasing. And that has a big impact on the automobile industry. The reason that these digital native young people that grew up with these new services and they're just naturally intuitive to them are using them more is because it's cheaper, it's affordable, reliable, it's easier, you know, people don't want to drive. And there's an APTA study that shows the more people use ride-sharing services, the more they use other modes. And when I think about Uber and its impact on transit, we compete with personal ownership of the vehicle. From a suburban mobility and outer borough mobility perspective, it's even more true. We compete with personal ownership of the vehicle. When people own a car, they have to insure it and garage it, depending on where you can park, and maintain it and fill it with gas. And once you incur all those costs to own this expensive hunk of metal that you don't use all the time, you're more likely to use it. And when people, and this is already happening, this is not academic, this is an observable phenomenon that young people use services like Uber. They also, when they don't own a car, they use rail, bus, walking, bike share, and all these other modes. And that is the future that I think is really exciting. And you look, okay, Summit, they don't want to build a parking garage. If you look at commuter rail parking lots around this region, they're all packed to the gills, all the way up and down the LIRR. All the way up and down the Metro North lines and into New Jersey and PATH. And those are all our most frequent drop-off points. And people don't want to. I know people that commute to the train just, you know, because of convenience. And that's what's actually exciting. If you look at our trip data and you put a pin down where a trip starts, and then you overlay the train stations for the regional rail network, it lights up like a Christmas tree. because it's that first mile, last mile solution. And it can, you know, we could think of policy solutions for a feeder that make it a feeder for transit. And then you fast forward to AV, I think we have to do that or else we could get into trouble.
Great. So I'd like the panel each to weigh in on the sort of this next topic, which is, you know, envision 10 years from now. And I've been spending a lot of time in LA, and they're very focused on 2028 because they have the Olympics, and they've got a whole series of initiatives, many of which are actually mobility improvements going to 2028. So in 2028, what kind of system do we want to have providing mobility, or what kind of network do we want to have providing mobility in outer borough locations in the suburbs? Is it the same conventional mass transit network that we have today? Do you believe that it's actually going to be dominated by driverless cars or something else? But what's the network and the system that we have? What are the values that we should be aspiring towards achieving, or the goals we should be aspiring towards achieving? This is a small question, by the way. And then, you know, the next part, and we can deal with that first, but the next part is really thinking about what are the plans we need to put in place to get there. So I'll go to Tabitha first.
Sure. So we absolutely should not have the conventional mass transit system that we have right now. One of the reasons is that, you know, in New York City, bus ridership has dropped 21% since 2002. There's a problem there, and it's a problem that we have to address if we're going to see the sort of ideal future that we are probably all imagining here for mass transit. So, for example, we want to see a future where we have high efficiency use of the streets so that we can dedicate more space in our cities to people, so that we can dedicate space to people walking, to children playing. And, you know, it's important that we actually plan for mass transit in that future, because if not, we could see a rise in the number of single occupancy vehicles, which is a big problem regardless of whether or not they're autonomous and green. And so it's something that should draw our attention to the need to really think about street design for the future right now. And thankfully, you know, some of the most important things that we need to do to design those streets for the future are the very things that we need to do to make transit work right now. So again, real dedicated transit lanes, space for people who are waiting for transit. And, you know, in New York City, our outer boroughs and even a lot of our suburban areas are dense enough so that that transit backbone is important. But being able to use transit for all purposes is also important. And being able to think about walking as an ideal first, last mile solution is also critical for that future of New York.
If I could just ask a follow-up, because it's something that I've thought about a lot, both as a transit industry professional and in my consulting work, sort of what is public transit? And, you know, I worked on a project for the taxi for the 100th anniversary of the taxis in 2007, and even though it's privately provided like Uber, at some level taxis are public transportation, because, you know, what it takes is, you know, you lifting an arm for a hail, or nowadays, you know, pressing a button on your phone or a screen on your phone to get a public ride. My sense is that a single occupant passenger taxi or Uber ride probably wouldn't qualify as public transit for purposes of a dedicated lane. But I'm curious to hear your sense as to what would the uses be in that lane besides, say, a bus?
Sure. I mean, I think the most important thing here is that we'd be using the space as efficiently as possible.
Right.
And so, you know, for that reason, we want to prioritize the highest capacity modes. It doesn't mean that in some areas we might not consider, you know, having a small shared van be able to access that lane, but that would be in a lower density area. So I think the question of whether or not we call it public is not so important. What's important is that we actually design the space and regulations so that we can use it to create the city that New York really could be in terms of fairness, people having access to opportunity, sustainability. It's totally in our power.
Great. So Tabitha, it's the highest efficiency use of the streets for people, and thinking about the street design of the for the future now, because it serves needs now. How about you, John?
So I think transit agencies need to start changing their focus and becoming more like mobility agencies. And we need to be thinking of alternative solutions to move people, especially in the rural and suburban areas. It's not sometimes cost effective to run a bus. You end up with that perception of having three seats being filled on a 30-foot bus, for instance. And by us looking at on-demand type services, being more flexible with the community's needs. We still have some of the issues that occur in urban areas, such as people working late nights, but when the transit system shuts down at 6 or 7 p.m., we're not able to provide opportunity for those to access late night employment for the lower income populations. So by looking into the partnerships with TNCs, creating micro transit type solutions, incorporating bike sharing, partnering with our cities, towns, and villages on making their communities walkable and including aspects of that mobility solution in those communities can be helpful in allowing transit to think beyond the conventional means and also attracting new people to riding public transportation that may not consider using public transit today.
So this is about like reinventing the public transit agency as, you know, I love mobility agency. You're thinking about how do you move people, possibly moving people and goods, but certainly how do you move people in the best way rather than it's about moving buses that happen to carry people.
That's correct, and especially yeah. in my community, especially cost efficiency is important.
Right.
And that by using these alternative means that can be more cost effective can demonstrate to the community right. that we're truly being efficient and using our tax dollars wisely.
Are there things, I imagine there must be, are there things that you know that you should and could be doing now and today, but there's some barrier that's stopping you from doing them to be more of a mobility agency?
It's engaging the community to think, as our county executive says, think differently, and getting them to understand what we can do that can benefit them. And I'll use the Poughkeepsie story as a perfect example. Took 25 years to consolidate the city's bus system and the county's bus system together. And when it finally happened, people were opposingly against the consolidation because they felt it was going to be a detriment to service. I've been with the county for 8 months. It took us that entire 8 month period to change people's perception that we actually are providing a much better service that's more efficient and that makes sense than what the city was able to provide. So just being able to convince people that change is good, change is not scary, and that these alternative means might make better sense than just following our conventional ways that we're used to.
Great. Margaret, your thoughts. Where should we be aspiring to be in 10 years? And how are we going to get there together?
Okay. Yeah, it's not a small question, as you said. I agree completely with John's comments about sort of having the right scale. I think we are particularly if you look around the city and you have very large vehicles, buses moving around, there's, I think, a kind of mismatch sometimes in terms of scale of the actual transit delivery piece compared to what you actually need. I think but then if you look at the choices people make, people are choosing to isolate themselves or to select the easiest mode, which is often ride hailing. And so I think there's a mismatch right now. How we get there, I think, is one of the biggest challenges that we face. And I will say, I think for me the key is perhaps not in the actual mode of transportation, but in the management of the streets. So it's in a governance. I think the key to this lies in, there was a lot of discussion in this morning's keynotes about congestion charging, whether that's, and obviously that for the second time around was not implemented. And I think some acknowledgement publicly from our governance and from our people understanding why that needs to happen. You can't manage transportation on the streets unless you manage the streets. So I think that's a direction that we need to go in. And
great. So,
go ahead.
Yeah, Jason, I was going to give you the option of either answering the same question, or I know that Uber has been out there in favor of congestion pricing. I've heard it particularly in favor of congestion pricing for the proposals that have been out there around Central Manhattan congestion pricing. But I'm kind of curious what's led you to take that position, And do you think, as Margaret's saying, that we might actually scale something like that and thinking about management and governance of the streets? I've thought for a long time that the streets are the largest public utility that we have that we charge absolutely nothing to use. And that applies as much in suburban and outer borough locations as well. So,
yeah, it's two questions that have the same answer. I think in 10 years, I think we need to have road pricing, because in places where the demand to use the roads exceeds the supply of road, and use of the roads in congested cities like New York is an unpriced externality, and the existing system doesn't work well. No one is really well served. So in those areas, like the CBD, when there are transit options, people should have to pay for the privilege of using a less efficient mode in order to reduce the demand. So the demand of people wanting to use the roads is more in line with the supply, because anyone who thinks that the current system is serving people well, I would love to debate that with them. So that's number one. That's why Uber supports congestion pricing. And there's a good policy argument for it. There's also a self-interested argument for it, in that the Uber riders and drivers are not getting to where they're going stuck in gridlock. So that's why we, not only do we support congestion pricing, we enthusiastically support congestion pricing and have been really vocal about lobbying for it. The second thing I would say very quickly is demand responsive transit in areas that aren't as congested. As John said, we have a partnership with Pinellas County, Florida, that would run empty buses at night, and they shut that down, and they give people free or subsidized Uber rides. Who are those people? They're second and third shift workers in retail and food service. These are low-income people that can't get around, and it's much better for everyone. It's better for Pinellas County, Florida. It's better for the second and third shift retail and food service workers, and I think you'll see more of that. And the third thing I would say is rewire the curb. This is kind of, everyone's kind of saying the same thing, but I think the curb is valuable real estate, and there's all kinds of bad policy incentives out there about off-street parking. I think we should go top to bottom and get rid of off-street parking requirements when you develop new construction, because I think that's nutty. It's sending the wrong incentive to people. So,
Jason, if I can just jump in on the Pinellas County example, I think it's just important to point out a few caveats on that. Yes, the agency was able to save money both overall and per rider, but riders are subject to surge pricing. Second thing, we've replaced bus operators with non-union labor. And third thing, the ridership is actually down on that service, and we don't know now who's not being served.
Those are all, and I welcome that, Tabitha, and I thank you for mentioning that. I guess, like, one blanket response is that one of the things that I really like about Uber is that people are voting with their feet. You know, a lot of the work, like, there's some pressure to make bus service, bus network redesigns are a very hot thing right now, and, like, buses are becoming cool again, and there's pressure on everyone to up their game, including, you know, people in the taxi industry and other, you know, for-hire parts of industry.
Great. Are there other questions that panel members have in response to things that you heard from Margaret, John, Tabitha?
I think I just wanted to add on the comment that Tabitha made and that Jason made. Even though that there's that surge pricing issue, and the rideship could be down in Pinellas County, one model that I have been investigating that I'm very interested in, and we're struggling with this in Poughkeepsie, because TNCs, even though they're being used, and they're being used to go to rail stations primarily, we don't have a whole lot of drivers. There's a city in Canada that actually pays an incentive out of their transit budget instead of starting a transit system where they incentivize residents to become drivers. And by incentivizing residents to become drivers, your friends or whatnot, that can increase the pool, which would reduce the surge pricing, which then, in theory, could potentially provide more mobility during those off hours when transit is not able to provide that service. So that's one thing that I would definitely like to pursue in our community.
I'd just like to add on Jason's comment about the curb pricing. And I think one thing we haven't touched on in terms of when you think about the sort of governance and people using the streets, as well as using Uber, people are also ordering
from Amazon and from other instant sort of delivery types of services. And I think going forward, when we think about the future, I think you can't think about transit and mobility without thinking about logistics and goods delivery. And people are making choices every day. I'm guilty of it. We all are. In terms of what we want instantly. And so the implications for that going forward, I think, are enormous in terms of how the curb gets utilized, particularly in denser urban areas. So we have to solve for that.
Right. So I'll just transition over to audience questions. But first, it sounds like there is consensus from the transit operator, from the advocate, Margaret's comment that what people are gravitating towards is what's easiest with the ride hail, that there's disruption going on, and that sometime in this 10-year window we actually have to sort out what is the public transit agency and public transit operations of the future if it wants to save itself, because I do think that these technologies and the options that are out there will result in people voting with their feet. So it's great to see John really thinking about this from a suburban and rural perspective, that Andy Byford's on top of it. So I think that it's heartening to see that we have leadership at agencies that's thinking about this, and hopefully that will be something that plays out throughout our whole region. So talking of disruptive technologies, it used to be that you could just raise your hand in a room and somebody would call on you for questions. Instead, we're going to have this heavily curated thing. Will they go away as I ask them? But why don't we start with Judy from the Broadway room asking what percentage of Uber rides are shared rides? My guess is that question might be on a New York regional basis.
So we don't have, I'm trying to text someone to see if we can get an answer, but TLC trip record data are public on TLC Open Data, so anyone can go and download trip records from any for-hire base. And the rules were recently changed to you have to mark whether a trip is shared or not. And by shared rides, there's technology called Uber Pool that takes two people going along the same route and combines them into one trip, and they get a lower price. So this is carpooling or ride sharing. I don't know, whatever you want to call it. And people have tried to do this since the 70s with the oil shocks, but we're doing it at scale. You can like it or dislike it, but it's a phenomenon. We're completing millions of pool trips. We're altering consumer behavior. One of the things I've learned working at Uber, it's very hard to change consumer behavior. Technology exists where you could have Google Glass or Snapchat spectacles and walk around with cameras and things, but people don't because you look funny and we're not used to that. But people are using Uber Pool at scale, and one of our engineering directors is in the room today. The engineering challenges, the math gets super hard on matching, millions and millions of trips, and we've worked really hard on getting it just right, where you're not in the burden of inconvenience versus price. It's a delicate thing. So that's a long answer. The short answer is we have a very high opt-in rate because you have to match the trips, right? And then the opt-in rate, by definition, is going to be a little lower than the match rate. And I didn't get the text back, but you should all explore the open data data set right on TLC. It's cool.
Just as a follow-up to that, and something that I've thought a lot about is, between whether it's Tabitha talking about street design and managed lanes or all of us talking about congestion pricing, Uber and, your competitors already provide an incentive with lower cost fare for a shared ride. But are there other ways that we could actually encourage Uber and Lyft to function more like public transit by, under the governor's current proposal, or the proposal that would charge TNCs, basically a per ride thing? Could you have that be much higher for a single ride and lower for a pooled ride?
In fact, it is.
Right.
In fact, it is. The new, it's not really a congestion thing. It's more of a revenue thing, honestly. But right, if you're in a shared ride, you pay a smaller fee. So let me ask that. I'll answer that question with a story, at the risk of telling a personal story. The other day, I work in West Chelsea and I had a meeting on East 23rd Street, and I didn't want to go down to the L train. I didn't want to take the 7. I was in a rush, so I took Uber. And I'm crossing town on 23rd Street, which is an SBS corridor, and the buses are zooming by me on SBS, and there's off-board fare payment, and all the doors open, and I'm sitting in one lane of traffic, and there's, you know, a UPS truck blocking the way, and I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute. So what did I do on the way home? I took the SBS, and I got off at 10th Avenue. I walked up the High Line and went right into my office. So that's a story, right? Like, I take whatever mode is best for me,
right,
and whatever works best for me. That's kind of the consumer perspective. And if it's easier to, if it's actually easier, faster, and better to take a bus and then kind of, you know, walk up the High Line, then, you know, that's the kind of mentality that I think we should have.
But if you knew before you got in the Uber, the cab, or whatever, that the shared ride was going to get priority, in other words, if you could put a shared ride service into those bus lanes, or it had, and you knew it was going to be faster, you might take that over, you know, for a couple dollars difference, I will always opt for a, you know.
I feel like, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that it's an absolute miracle that the UPS truck was not parked in the bus. That was a miracle that you experienced.
Right. I was just going to say, in this data-rich age, you know, it just seems that the world is crying out, or regions are crying out, for a single app where, you know, you say, I want to get from here to there, and it tells you price, timing, and carbon footprint of walking, bike share, taking a cab, taking an Uber pool, taking a bus, and it, you know, somebody in your company or somewhere else has got to, you know, come up with it, and I'm sure that there are all sorts of logistical hurdles to it. Data probably is not necessarily one of it. That data is coming from lots of different sources is. All right, let's go with the next question. So, Darius from NJIT, I assume, suburbs are complex social ecosystems, including ethnoburbs and a large K-12 population, yet most transit is designed for commuting to work. How can we adapt?
I can take on that one first. Some of the things that we're doing in Dutchess County to address this, and this is an actual issue in our community, we're one of the probably the last suburban counties where we still have a walking district, and we have people that are in the middle school and the high school that at walk upwards of 3 miles to get to school, and that the district does not provide busing. And when it snows, when it's too hot, kids don't go to school, and the attendance rate is extremely low in the Poughkeepsie City School District. We're actually, we presented a proposal, and it's being vetted by their board, to where we're gonna allow them to utilize the bus system free of charge, and that they're going to ask their voters within their district to subsidize that. What's going to happen is that everyone can just show their ID and ride any Dutchess County public transit bus free of charge. They can usually go to school, they can usually go to after school jobs, they can usually come home from after school, go to zero period in the morning. There might be some students that may never touch the bus, but the intent is that those ones that don't utilize the service would in essence be subsidizing those that truly would need the service. And that's kind of our ways of thinking of how we can start attracting more than just the typical people that are commuting to and from work. We also have the same relationship with our colleges, Marist College, Dutchess Community College, and Vassar College. And we're also working on a partnership similar like that with the Culinary Institute of America and Bard College. So hopefully we'll get all the educational institutions on board. And then it's another way of increasing our ridership on the system. And we're gonna look at also expanding that to alternative modes as we start looking at alternative ways of delivering service in our county.
Even though it's a question about the suburbs, I think it applies just as much to some of our outer borough locations. And Tabitha, I'm wondering if you have thoughts about how we should be adapting to meet trip needs besides the trip to work.
Sure. Well, the announcement this week by New York City Transit that they'll be doing a full network redesign of New York City's bus routes is great. You know, we can foresee much better connections between outer borough areas, and we can foresee transit service that will solve the problem described earlier, where people are trying to travel either within their home borough or to another one, and currently not able to do that without traveling quite far out of the way to do so.
Right. Great. There's a next question, which from the algorithm has come up. I think it's an extraordinarily important question about development and gentrification. However, I'm going to just make the executive decision that our panel probably has opinions on it, but it's not necessarily our areas of expertise, and So I'd be happy to talk with whoever put that up later about that. What about, you know, the next question is really about transit out access for, it's a two-part thing. It's really about transit deserts in outer borough locations, but really addressing issues of equity. And I'd like the panel to talk about it and talk about it both in the context of what are the things we can be doing now, and also what are some of the ways in which we can mitigate some of the concerns about equity associated with things like congestion pricing and road pricing. So it's not, you know, what we don't want, and I'm sure what Uber doesn't want is only to have its drivers and single riders be the ones who have the fastest trip. How do we make sure that there is actually an acceptable level of service and mobility options for everyone? I'll let Jason take it.
Yeah,
first
well,
crack.
I mean, one answer is if you look at for hire, the utilization of vehicles was previously really low, and people would only do a couple trips a day, and the cost per trip would be very high, and you know, car services would line up at law firms and banks in Midtown and drive people home at night. You know, that was the model. But now, if you put the driver only makes money when there's someone in the vehicle. And if you have someone in the vehicle a lot more and you use technology to do that, you can lower the price. And that's exactly what's happened. Also, the dispatch method of put your hand in the air focuses on density. 93% of yellow taxi trips in New York City are in Manhattan. 93% of yellow taxi trips are in Manhattan because they sensibly go to where the business is and where the density is. And that's in your Midtown hotels and in the CBD. Uber, as I said before, over half our trips are outside Manhattan. And because it turns out when your dispatch method is the smartphone, you don't need to be high density. You could do really well in medium density. You could actually do really well in low density. And we do. And that's why we complete all these trips in suburban areas. I don't know about rural. So, you know, I think the core product, and if you look, you know, there's a commuting wave in parts of central Brooklyn. That is, you know, transit that is not well served by mass transit. That's where we do really well. And by the way, here's another thing. Around the world, in places that have really good taxi service with new cars and courteous service, Uber doesn't do that well. And in places that have inferior service or high prices or not courteous service or service refusals, that's where we do really well.
I think on the equity side, it's this challenge that you always have with equity and efficiency. You can't necessarily put a bus route that runs like every 15 minutes in a rural area when you don't have the density to support something like that. So it goes back to the alternative service delivery model and looking at what is appropriate for those lower density areas for those that are in the lower income population. I actually have an area in our county. Extreme rural. It's the northeastern portion of Dutchess County, borders Connecticut. And we used to have a bus route that circulated out there every 90 minutes. It was discontinued back in 2009, and they've been crying for public transit service since then. We do give them this very inefficient dial-a-ride service that allows people to go upwards of 45 miles one way for as low as $6. Subsidy per passenger is around the $65 time cost and highly inefficient. So what we're trying to do is we're working with that community to see what is more appropriate for them so we can give them an equal level of transit that we would give to somebody in Beacon or in Poughkeepsie or in Hyde Park and still have them access to other services. And one thing that we're talking about doing is volunteer transportation, where we would reimburse people at the IRS rate. They find a friend. They get that friend to drive them to wherever they go, file a claim with the agency, and we would compensate them for that ride. And by doing that model, we'll still give those people choices to use transit whenever they want to use it, not on our schedule. And we're doing it at a much lower cost than sending a bus route out there that may carry nobody.
Tabitha, do you have thoughts on transit deserts and equity?
Yeah, well, you know, in New York City, we have a lot of outer borough areas that are both low income and high density. So I'm thinking about neighborhoods like East Flatbush, Hunts Point. And so we actually have a huge opportunity here to provide fast, reliable transit service. And we absolutely can do it. And that is the answer to solving the outer boroughs sort of, you know, transit needs right now. It's quite a different picture from in suburban counties that are lower density or rural areas. So, you know, thankfully, I think the challenge is a little bit more straightforward to address in New York City.
Great. So the next question is really about governance. And in suburban areas, you know, it require that this kind of vision requires some kind of mobility management role from someone. Traditional transportation agencies are certain not to be good at it. I'd say, you know, not every suburban transit agency can have John running them. But how should we be thinking about governance, and sort of what are the characteristics that we should be thinking about for the organizations that should be providing these mobility options for the future, and how do we find effective leadership for them?
I think you really have to start looking. Not to single point management, but you're connecting now, I think, particularly in these sort of outer borough and suburban areas, you're connecting one community to the next. You're not necessarily connecting back to a city center. And I think that if you don't have some kind of a regional management for it, there's just no way to make it work. The state is sort of too large and too kind of ungovernable, I think, as it. So, I mean, the regional plan, if you turn the regional plan association, if you turned it into an actual governing body, could do a pretty good job. I think that organizations like that that understand the, you know, the sort of larger picture,
right.
You know, and not all of, I don't know what the size of your organization is, but I think that's always a challenge in some of these smaller communities to have enough people within the governing body to actually run them. So I do think it has to be, we have to figure out some regional models that work.
I would definitely agree. And we have to start thinking, when it comes to transit, I like to say we have to think transit beyond boundaries.
Right.
And the Poughkeepsie-Dutchess County merger is a perfect example of that. We have Dutchess County routes overlaying City of Poughkeepsie routes that are basically, we're driving down the same street, like literally minutes behind each other, and people were in essence having a choice to choose between us or them, and we were just wasting tax dollars. We had excess overhead from the county side and the city side to provide the same level of service that we're now being able to do with one. We are actually getting ready to award a contract on a more regional scale to do a regional transit plan to look at how can we now think more globally about moving people between Orange, Ulster, and Dutchess counties, because we're starting to see that people aren't just doing jobs or going to education within Dutchess County. They're actually now going to Orange County and Ulster County and even to the counties to the north and south of us for other opportunities. And the way our transit systems are, we don't cross county lines. We all stay within our own county, so we're already creating artificial barriers for those that don't have opportunities to use other modes. So this regional transit study will definitely help us in looking on how we can address cross-county mobility.
Jason, do you have thoughts about governance models, whether in the public sector or private sector, for providing these better options?
Portland has that, I believe. They have kind of a regional body that does sanitation and transit and all that stuff, mm-hmm. So they have it. But we have RPA, which has that long-term perspective that you have elected officials who are, you know, have a shorter cycle where project, maybe it is not in their interest to, you know, invest in the water tunnel number 3 or things that are going to have a payoff in decades from now, and maybe we need that. And I can't profess to get into the politics of it, but it's RPA's kind of civic vantage is really valuable in that regard.
Interested in the panelists' thought. I think we probably have time for a couple more questions, but interested in the panelists' thought on the question on bus-like for-hire vehicles or on-demand microtransit services like Chariot or VIA that have fixed routes, and how should we be thinking about those? How should we be thinking them with fixed routes or with flexible routes?
Well, actually, I'm curious to hear what Jason has to say about this, because my impression has been that these kinds of fixed route services have very low ridership. And we, for example, in our office yesterday did an experiment where a couple of my colleagues took Chariot from Brooklyn to the office just to see what it was like, and they were the only two people on the vehicle for the entire ride. Mm. So it sort of confirmed our suspicions, but I'm wondering if you have a sense of what the actual numbers are.
There was a company named Bridge, with a J, that had basically a demand responsive bus. It was like Uber Pool, but it was a bus, and it would drive around based on where people were pressing, right, you know, the button, which is actually an interesting idea. And they wanted to license the technology, and they were operational, I think, in D.C. or maybe in Boston. And they went out of business.
Kansas City, I think, too.
Yes. So I think it's a good idea, but they went out of business, and if people aren't taking it, so someone's going to get it right. My belief is that companies should use private dollars to experiment to try and figure out the way to get it right, and government should set the rules of the road and provide consumer protections and safety and you know, make sure the curb is managed and all those things, and let all these companies either invest money and become successful and provide a great service, or waste the money and go out of business, and that's how we'll figure stuff out.
So I wonder if it's possible that, you know, assuming that private sector and business will take care of this need that we have, when much of the public transit is subsidized in some way, it's not a kind of money-making or profitable enterprise. And I think that I was thinking, you asked an earlier question about how we could have the idea of microtransit. If it's on demand, in other words, to satisfy the transit desert piece, if you could sort of dial up a route, even though you said if it's a fixed route, people don't ride it, but if it's, you know, where people need to go, then people will probably use it. If you made it the same price as a subway ride, it would be, people would definitely use it. So I think there's a question about what the public sector should be providing. It certainly would be cheaper to have have the city operate some kind of a public Uber service that was subsidized than to build another $1 billion, you know, third phase of the Second Avenue subway. So I think maybe we shouldn't go there. But I do think that the notion that the private sector should somehow and pick up this shortage is maybe a little misguided.
Okay. Well, I think that we have to be mindful, though, in regards to these type of on-demand services, because I've been monitoring these public transit agency operated mobility on demand services. In my personal opinion, it appears it's just Dial-A-Ride. It's Dial-A-Ride with an app. And my experience in running Dial-A-Ride is that high subsidy cost that I'm faced with right now. If I just added an app to our current way of how we do our Dial-A-Ride, I don't think it's going to lower my cost per passenger. I might get maybe a few more additional riders using the system, but I'm going to still have that challenge of puzzling people within a certain service area to get them around that service area. So I think we just have to be mindful of how we deliver those mobility on-demand services, especially when we're utilizing the much more expensive labor to do so. Right.
There's a huge opportunity in Accessoride, too. I mean, paratransit systems are not serving riders as well as they could, and it's not serving taxpayers well, and Uber has a partnership with MBTA in Massachusetts, the ride program, where you're looking at an average cost to provide a trip on the ride in paratransit. This could be upwards of like $50, and we could do those trips with a 5-minute ETA for $8. And we're doing it. It's a pilot. It's live right now, and MTA in New York is looking to explore a pilot as well. So there's a huge opportunity there to provide a better service. A lot of Accessoride, you have to call 24 hours in advance. You get a 2-hour pickup window, and it doesn't need to be that way.
Great. So I want to thank the panelists. It sounds like we've got some great vision about how the streets of the future and suburbs and outer boroughs should really be about high efficiency, about the movement of people, that we need to think about public transit agencies morphing themselves to thinking about the movement of people rather than the movement of buses and trains and becoming mobility agencies. There are opportunities for the private sector, and it sounds like there's a wish or vision that this on-demand type bus network that responds to what users want to do seems like it should be a good idea for part of the transportation puzzle, but today is not actually something that's market feasible or sensible for the public sector to provide on a per subsidy basis. So hopefully those of us on the panel, as well as those of you in the room, can really think about these issues as we think about improving mobility options for suburbs and outer borough places in the future. I'm sure that RPA would love to get some feedback on the Slido tool as well as on the panel, and there'll probably be some way to do that. But I want to thank the audience for the questions you've asked, and thank in particular this expert panel that we had with us. So Jason, Margaret, John, Tabitha, thank you. Nice to meet all.
It's literally a